on, Stockall says. But it requires a translation. We can only communicate part of whatever our brain processes. What we are doing with this new technology is kind of reversing the process a step at a time, taking signals from the brain and with minimal translation, putting them back in another person's brain. Experiments filmed in Stockow's laboratory on August 12, 2013, performed in collaboration with computational neuroscientist Raish Rao, demonstrated synthetic telepathy between two human test subjects for the first time in human history. In 2014, direct brain-to-brain communication was achieved on an international scale, this time by a team of scientists led by Dr. Alvaro Pascual Leone, professor of neurology at the Harvard Medical School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, using the internet as a pathway. The work was partially financed by the European Commission's Future and Emerging Technology Program, often referred to as the EU's DARPA. The telepathy experiment involved technology, not ESP, Dr. Pascual Leone assured me in a telephone interview in 2015. The sender, or emitter, sat in a laboratory in Tiruvannamalai, India, wearing an EEG cap that detected and captured the brain's electromagnetic activity. Using the same system of messaging developed by Edmond Dewan in the 1960s, this sender transmitted the mental message hola, hello in Spanish, to three test subjects sitting in a laboratory in Strasbourg, France. Each recipient in France wore on his head a magnetic field generating device called a transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS, cap. The test subjects in France received the sender's information as a sequence of tiny jolts to their occipital lobes, which caused sensations and showed up as flashes of light in the corner of their vision. As a result of this experiment, a coded message was successfully transferred between human brains, separated by a distance of approximately 5,000 miles. By using advanced precision neurotechnologies, including wireless EEG and roboticized TMS, we were able to directly and non-invasively transmit a thought from one person to another, without the person having to use language to speak or to write, Dr. Pascual Leone said. It is a remarkable step in human communication. These direct brain-to-brain communication technologies would have been impossible to fathom in an earlier age. In the modern era, they have become reality. With technology-based synthetic telepathy research, far outpacing traditional forms of mental telepathy research, what might become of psychic research? Chapter 24, The Scientists and the Skeptics. Three pioneers involved in the government's anomalous mental phenomena programs, ones that began in the 1970s, remain active in the work, still searching for the source of the phenomena. Since 1985, Hal Puthoff has been chief scientist at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Austin in Texas. Located in the suburbs, the facility is a two-story brick and glass building surrounded by oak and elm trees in a research park. Inside the lab, some of the most exotic propulsion physics research in the nation takes place. The Institute's research arm, Earth Tech International, manages 32 subcontracts, mostly military and intelligence related. As chief scientist, Puthoff oversees the work of three physicists and two experimenters. We pursue novel ideas in gravity, cosmology, and new sources of energy, he tells me when I visit the Institute in 2015. The client list includes the Department of Defense, NASA, Lockheed's Skunk Works, and the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency's 100-Year Starship Project for interstellar travel capabilities. Putoff confirmed that he continues to act as a consultant on government black programs. Yes, I presently work on classified programs in the aerospace sector, he says. Given my past activities, I fall into the class of consultants that, when an enigma arises, I get the call. Putoff shows me around the lab, which takes up the ground floor. It's filled with measuring systems, gauges, and analytical instruments. Sources at the Defense Intelligence Agency confirmed to me that EarthTech International has, for years, maintained a Defense Department contract to investigate what are known as excess energy claims, devices that allege to be powered by things like magnetic motors and cold fusion, also known as low-energy nuclear reactions. It is ironic that a scientist who has spent decades of his professional life fighting claims by skeptics that he is a fringe scientist is in fact one of the go-to people when the Defense Department needs a credible laboratory to disprove an extraordinary excess energy claim. These claims are the primary focus of our investigations here, Putoff says. So far, we have disproven all of them. The findings are made public on the EarthTech website. At the Institute, Putoff works in yet another domain of contemporary physics fraught with contention. This work involves quantum vacuum energy, or zero-point energy, Nullpunkt's energy, a concept originally developed by Max Planck in 1911. Planck's work on quantum theory won him a Nobel Prize in 1918. The contentious aspect is not whether zero-point energy exists, but whether it can be harnessed for useful purposes. If proven, says Putoff, zero-point energy could be a radical breakthrough in deep space propulsion technologies. The possibility of extracting useful energy from vacuum fluctuations would be the holy grail of energy research, he says. For example, a manned space probe powered by zero-point energy could, theoretically, make a trip to Mars in 7 to 40 days, depending on the separation distance between Earth and Mars, as opposed to NASA's current figure, using more traditional advanced propulsion techniques, of 7 or 8 months. Critics deride Putoff's efforts. In my interview with Lawrence M. Krauss, the astrophysicist known for popularizing the term dark energy, Krauss stated that harnessing quantum vacuum energy was impossible. Zero-point energy is the lowest point in the universe. If you could extract energy out of it, there would have to be a lower point. There isn't a lower step on the staircase, so by definition, if it exists, it can't be used. Krauss called Putoff a crackpot and added, besides, he has a history of backing crazy schemes. Then Krauss said something interesting. Views of reality must conform to reality, not the way you want the world to be. If zero-point energy were feasible or available, the universe would have used it, Krauss observed. But Einstein taught us that two contradictory pictures of reality can and do exist when he spoke of the wave-particle duality that is quantum mechanics. Scientists who have witnessed ESP and PK phenomena, Putoff among them, seem to have a different view of reality than scientific skeptics, including Krauss. To harness zero-point energy could, Putoff posits, lead to a general theory about ESP and PK phenomena. In our interview, he summarizes this hypothesis. Throughout mankind's cultural history, there has existed the metaphysical concept that man and cosmos are interconnected by a ubiquitous, all-pervasive sea of energy that undergirds and is manifest in all phenomena. This pre-scientific concept of a cosmic energy goes by many names in many traditions, he says, citing the Chinese concept of qi and the Hindu concept of prana as examples. He wonders whether this metaphysical concept of cosmic energy is analogous to zero-point energy. In pursuit of this theory, Puthoff and his team conduct quantum optic experiments using lasers, beam splitters, lenses, and diffraction gratings. It's a challenging long-term quest, he says. At age 80, he has no intention of slowing down. Puthoff's search echoes what China's H.S. Chen proposed in a discipline he called somatic science, where man, humanity, is considered to be a giant system embedded in the supergiant system of a cosmic world. Research experiments in this field, wrote Chen, would likely lead to an increased understanding that all of us are immersed, both as living and physical beings, in an overall interpenetrating and interdependent field in ecological balance with the cosmos as a whole. Chen believed that this vital force, known as qi, was the key to the next scientific revolution. This from the man who co-developed the original U.S. rocket program, co-founded the Jet Propulsion Lab, and built China's rocket, satellite, and manned space programs. In 2007, Aviation Week and Space Technology named Chen the Person of the Year and put him on the magazine's cover. China is now at the forefront of space exploration, with two key developments in 2007, a successful anti-satellite ASAT weapons test and a planetary mission, wrote the magazine's editor-in-chief. The article highlighted Chen's primary role in China's early aerospace programs and his enduring legacy in the modern era. That same year, New Scientist named Chen one of the top 10 influential space thinkers of all time. Because of the stigma associated with anomalous mental phenomena research, including extraordinary human body function, EHBF, ESP, and PK, Chen's work in this area has remained almost entirely unreported in the West. He died in October 2009 in Beijing at the age of 98. To interview Dale Graff, I traveled in 2015 to Pennsylvania, where he and his wife Barbara live in the country not far from where they both grew up. I confirmed with Barbara the near-drowning story that happened in the strong surf off Hawaii in 1968, and that the couple did not speak of this mysterious existential event for roughly 30 years. It was Graff's conversion moment, he agrees. In service of a general theory about ESP and PK, he continues his research and experiments today at age 82. In the 70s and 80s, we were looking at the electromagnetic spectrum, he says. Now it's quantum physics, non-locality, and quantum entanglement, or what Einstein famously called spooky action at a distance. The concept of quantum entanglement is difficult to comprehend, yet has been elegantly simplified by the theoretical physicist Michio Kaku. Kaku explains quantum entanglement this way. According to the quantum theory, everything vibrates. When two electrons are placed close together, they vibrate in unison. When you separate them, that's when all the fireworks start, where quantum entanglement begins. An invisible umbilical cord emerges connecting these two electrons, and you can separate them by as much as a galaxy if you want. Then, If you vibrate one of them, somehow on the other end of the galaxy, the other electron knows that its partner is being jiggled, he says. While entanglement has puzzled physicists ever since Einstein spoke of it, most scientists originally disputed it, quantum entanglement is now an accepted theory. Today, physicists create entangled particles in huge numbers in labs all over the world, the MIT Technology Review reported in February 2016. They routinely use entanglement to send perfectly encrypted messages, to study quantum computation, and to better understand the nature of this profound phenomenon. Where this profound phenomenon gets spookier still is the question of how quantum entanglement might affect the forward one-directionality of time, time's arrow that governs the universe as a whole. Some physicists suspect that causality, the relationship between cause and effect, itself may be different when it comes to the phenomenon of quantum entanglement. The PBS Nova reporter Allison Eck explains it this way. Entangled particles start off close together, and when separated, they're able to communicate with each other and share information at a rate that's seemingly instantaneous, faster than the speed of light. Whatever one particle does, the other follows suit in a consistent way. But according to the theory of relativity, nothing can travel that quickly, i.e. faster than the speed of light. Here is where some physicists and philosophers of science, including Dale Graff, propose the impossible. They say the solution could lie in a contentious concept called retrocausation or backward causation. The idea that the future might influence the past, says Graff. In a Nova Science Now article titled "Retrocausality Could Send Particles Information Back to the Future," Eck interviews physicists at the University of Cambridge who are conducting experiments to this end. In our non-quantum lives, we can't see these things happening. We're locked into our perception of time and causality. Time is still a forward arrow, and action comes before reaction, she writes. At the particle level, though, some physicists believe this logic could be sound, and they're beginning to use it, i.e. retrocausation, to explain existing results. Dale Graff is one of those physicists. In 2016, I met up with him at the Quantum Retrocausation 3 Symposium at the University of California, San Diego. There, Graff delivered a lecture entitled "Perceiving the Future News: Evidence for Retrocausation." He discussed the data he'd obtained from a recent series of remote viewing experiments with a viewer in Florida who allegedly used precognition to view photographs in Graff's local paper days in advance of when the AP photographs were taken. Graff displayed his data as a series of slides and gave his analysis as he presented them. The majority of those in the audience were PhDs and doctoral students interested in and accepting of retrocausation as a thought experiment, Schmeidler's sheep. For a skeptic, the lack of scientific controls would be self-evident. One would have to take Graff at his word that the experiment unfolded as he said it did. After Graff finished, there was a question and answer period. A man in the audience raised his hand. "What you're talking about has already been discredited," he declared in an angry tone. "The U.S. Army ran a remote viewing program in the 1980s, and it turned out to be total garbage." A lively discussion ensued. "There is an underlying reality," Graff insists. "Remote viewing illustrates that this underlying reality exists, although it is the tip of the iceberg. It bubbles up in places like precognition." To interview Kit Green, I traveled to Detroit, where Green has returned to private medical practice and also serves at the Wayne State University School of Medicine in Michigan. Over the past 13 years, Dr. Green has been a professor in the departments of psychiatry and radiology at the Harper University Hospital and the Detroit Medical Center, and served as the medical school's executive director for emergent technologies, i.e., forensic brain scanning applications. Green's career path is unusual for a former intelligence officer. He returned to medical practice after a long, meritorious government career. These new positions afford access to state-of-the-art technology in high-field brain MRIs, neuroradiology, and software, Green says. And he exploits this technology, he explains, in order to pursue an area of research that he had not publicly shared until our interviews for this book. Green's identity as a CIA officer remained secret until 2007, when he appeared in an episode of the PBS series Secrets of the Dead. The episode, called Umbrella Assassin, was a Cold War case file involving the murder of Bulgarian dissident Yorgai Markov, killed at a bus stop in England in 1978. If we hadn't suspected Markov had been murdered by the KGB, says Green, his death would have likely been written off as cause unknown, or death from natural causes. But because Green and his CIA colleagues had a strong hypothesis to work from, they went the extra mile in the laboratory. Our intelligence services found a tiny platinum-iridium pellet in Markov's leg and removed it. We prescribed specialized blood tests and identified ricin, which we looked for because of the victim's signs and symptoms. An assassin used a weapon disguised as an umbrella, says Green. For his work breaking this and other forensic medical cases over the next 5 years, Green was awarded the National Intelligence Medal. After Green officially left the CIA in 1985, he worked for General Motors Research Labs and was eventually promoted to Chief Technology Officer for Asia Pacific. He has remained an active military and intelligence science advisor to the CIA and the Department of Defense, serving on more than 20 defense science and advisory boards. His positions have included chairman of numerous National Academy of Sciences boards and studies, fellow, American Academy of Forensic Sciences, founding member, Defense Intelligence Agency, Technology, Insight, Gauge, Evaluate, and Review Committee, chairman of the Independent Science Panel for the Undersecretary of the Army for Operations Research, and later for the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Chemical, Biological, and Nuclear Matters. He also recently served as chairperson of a 19-member National Research Council effort to examine the future of military intelligence, science, and brain research over the next 20 years. Green's bona fides are clearly not lacking. In 2016, he was asked to join a classified science advisory board for James R. Clapper, Director of National Intelligence, to whom the directors of all 17 U.S. intelligence agencies and organizations report, and the man who, in the 1990s, as director of DIA, criticized the anomalous mental phenomena programs, calling them just too far out at the leading edge of technology. Kit Green finds advising the Defense Department and intelligence community stimulating and challenging, he says. But what interests him most is his work for 11 years now in his private medical practice. I'm interested in the notion of people injured physically by anomalous events, Green tells me. Often, these events are perceived as involving unidentified aerial phenomena, or UAPs, drones, high-energy radio frequencies that confront people face-to-face and cannot be explained. In an earlier age, some UAPs were known as UFOs. Green does not agree with the use of that term because it is imprecise, he says. But the nomenclature change helps to destigmatize the research. Hillary Clinton spoke of UAPs while on the 2016 campaign trail. The impetus of Green's work, he says, can be traced back to an unresolved component of the CIA's psychic research program in late 1974. The notion of people touched by anomalous events was a concept that Green was first confronted with when working with Uri Geller and the nuclear scientists at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. These individuals carried top-secret clearances that were as high as mine, says Green, including Q clearances for nuclear secrets. And yet they told me they saw things that could not be easily explained. They reported seeing raven-like birds on their bedposts, orbs floating down the hallways in their homes, a disembodied arm hovering in the air. These individuals were not crazy, he says. To paranormalists, these close contact sightings are known as close encounters. The idea of close encounters touches upon a lot of pathologies, says Green, but not all encounters involve pathologies. This mystery plagued him for decades, he says. In 2005, he began working on a research project to address this enigma. He began creating a structured database of individuals that were suffering enigmatic injuries, burns, skin lesions, cancers, diseases, and who also had face-to-face encounters with UAPs, says Green. We would comb through each narrative, remembers Green, compare statistics, pare the information down, pull out people with pathologies. What was left? Many very interesting cases, cases that could not be easily explained. After 2 years of data analysis, in 2007, Green took this research project from academic to operational. I began performing much pro bono work, he says, forensic investigation and diagnosis of patients injured by multiply witnessed physical anomalous events with UAPs, drones, and other visibly physical devices. Green accepted his patients carefully. They are all high-functioning individuals, many prodigious savants, most of whom carry a high security clearance, he says. They are members of special forces, members of the intelligence community, employees of aerospace companies, officers in the military, guards of military bases, policemen. Often injuries take place on a military bivouac, which is an overnight mission at a secure location for the purpose of guarding, reconnaissance, or some kind of exploration. Common injuries are from something that is airborne, something that emits some kind of a light or a beam, some orbs. Green takes on patients who already have a thick physician case file and whose doctors have been unable to determine what injured them. My patients were physically injured by something. They have signs on their body, markings, illness, he says. They agree to give Green access to their medical history and permission for him to speak with their other doctors. None have mental illness. They and their physicians have exhausted many avenues and find themselves at the end of their rope, says Green. These patients are by majority not prone to conspiracy or PTSD. This kind of thinking would interfere with their career path. They and usually their superiors come to me because my specialty is forensic medicine. I try to determine diagnosis from very little and often highly incomplete data, like the assassinations he investigated while at the CIA. Using the technology available to him, Green orders brain scans, specialized blood, DNA, and endocrine tests, and compiles the results. At present, he has more than 100 active patients. His original hypothesis was that a majority of his patients had been exposed to technology from black programs, he says. That is, advanced, state-of-the-art, high-energy technologies developed in special access programs. Non-lethal weapons programs, holograms, cloaking devices, drones. 25% of my patients die within 5 to 7 years of my diagnosis, and I have no idea of how any programs I knew about years ago can do these things, Green says. To advance his hypothesis based on the demographics and high functioning of his patients, Green teamed up with the Nolan Lab at Stanford University, run by Gary Nolan, one of the world's leading research scientists specializing in genetics, immunology, and bioinformatics. Nolan trained under the Nobel Prize-winning biologist David Baltimore, has published over 200 research papers, and holds 20 biotechnology patents. Age 55, he has been honored as one of the top 20 inventors at Stanford University. His research is funded by grants from the National Institutes of Health, the Food and Drug Administration, the National Cancer Institute, and others. In 2012, Nolan was awarded the Teal Innovator Award from the Defense Department, a $3.3 million grant for advanced cancer studies. The Nolan Lab is perhaps best known for pioneering advances in large-scale mapping of cellular features and human cells at an unprecedented level of detail. We are building on technologies that are just coming into existence, Nolan told me in 2016. Dr. Kit Green and his colleagues sought out Gary Nolan for help. I have met and worked with many of Kit's patients, Nolan confirms, and I have looked deeply at the relevant medical data. These people were injured. I have seen the physiological consequences of the harm they've endured. He agrees with Kit Green that in many cases, it looks as if it is an electromagnetic field of some sort. It has led to inflammation and other biomarkers in their bodies that can be seen in MRIs, tissue, blood. We are now working on both the genetic and epigenetic component, Nolan says. I am relatively certain we are the only individuals in the field doing this. Using mapping technology the Nolan Lab is renowned for, technicians are mapping Green's patients' DNA and their immune systems. They are looking for patterns among the patients, using biological data to create an integrated theory. All kinds of trauma can be picked up by the immune system, Nolan says. Every event that happens to you is recorded by your immune system, which in turn creates a biological database of the self. Every surgery or bee sting, he says, every incident of H1N1 flu, head cold, allergy, or chickenpox is all sensed and recorded by the immune system. With the technology that is emerging from the Nolan Lab, doctors will likely soon be able to take a snapshot of a person's blood and read the historical record of that person's physiological life. Access to this kind of high-technology, non-subjective biological data would have been impossible to imagine in any other age. But what, I ask Gary Nolan, does this have to do with anomalous mental phenomena research, with ESP and PK, with Uri Geller and hallucinations experienced by scientists at the Lawrence Livermore Nuclear Laboratory? We are also mapping DNA and immune systems of people and their families who claim to be remote viewers or have anomalous perception, Nolan confirms. For example, Joe McMonagle is part of their research program. He provided them with a sample of his DNA, and the team is considering how to access the DNA of his deceased twin sister, who was allegedly a remote viewer, says Nolan. Whether real, perceived, or illusion, there appears to be a genetic determinant. And while Dr. Green maintains that his patient's injuries may have come from high-energy devices or their components, both Green and Nolan think there is more to it than that. Some people seem to repeatedly attract the phenomena or the experiences, Nolan says. They act like an antenna or are like lighthouses in the dark. For some, it might be a blessing, Nolan speculates. They are comfortable with these occurrences and make it work in their lives. Think Uri Geller, Joe McMonagle, Angela Della Fiora, and Paul Smith. For others, it's a curse. For example, Green's injured patients and the Livermore nuclear scientists who quit their jobs. Nolan makes clear that his ideas are only hypotheses, but he explains the raw data from which his hypotheses have been drawn are clear. It's important to remember DNA does not invent stories, he says. Gene mapping and advanced single-cell analysis techniques reveal biological truths. Imagine if you could understand how this all connects to mentation, i.e. mental activity, Nolan says of claimed UAP encounters and ESP or PK abilities. You could make a drug to block the genetic aspect for those who don't want it, or even enhance it for others. In effect, Kit Green and Gary Nolan are searching for a gene for paranormality, or as Green prefers to say, the genomics of supernormality. The skeptics, led by Martin Gardner, Ray Hyman, and Paul Kurtz, the founders of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, PSYCOP, have maintained an almost united front around their message for more than 40 years. In the middle 1970s, they asked, why the sudden explosion of interest, even among some otherwise sensible people, in all sorts of paranormal happenings? Surely skeptics are asking that same question today. In 2006, the group removed the word paranormal from its name and shortened it to the Committee for Skeptics Inquiry. They continue to promote science and reason and, they say, work to resist the spread of pseudoscience, superstition, and irrational beliefs, which members believe includes any concept of God. There have been a few notable cracks in the unity. Fads and Fallacies author Martin Gardner, generally accepted as the father of the modern scientific skepticism movement, experienced a religious epiphany that he discussed openly before his death in 2010. He told the people around him that he believed in a supernatural being, a higher power or God, asserting that his belief was not pseudoscience because it could neither be confirmed nor disproved by science or reason. I believe in a personal God, he stated in an interview in 2008, and I believe in an afterlife, and I believe in prayer, but I don't believe in any established religion. This is called philosophical theism. Philosophical theism is entirely emotional. God is the great magician, he wrote. In 2011, Martin Gardner's magician friend, James Randi, was exposed as being involved in a decades-long double deception and criminal fraud. It was revealed that Randi's Carlos the Channeler hoax involved a federal crime. This created a public relations problem for the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry because the group vows to disseminate factual information about such hoax claims to the scientific community, the media, and the public. Here was one of their highest profile members perpetrating a fraud. The crime took more than 25 years to uncover, according to the New York Times. In 2011, federal agents knocked on Randy's front door in Florida and asked to speak with a man who went by the name of Jose Alvarez, the same Jose Alvarez who, according to the publicity material given to 60 Minutes and other news outlets, had played Carlos the Chandler in the hoax decades earlier. A man, 33 years Randy's junior, emerged from elsewhere in the house. Jose was Randy's long-term boyfriend. The two men came out of the closet together in 2008. Federal agents cuffed Alvarez, read him his Miranda rights, took him out of the car, took him to Broward County Jail, and registered him as FNULNU, first name unknown, last name unknown, the New York Times reported. At the county jail, the man told federal agents that his real name was Davy Orangal Peña Ortega, that he'd come to this country in the mid-1980s, met James Randi in a Florida public library, and fallen in love. He didn't want to go back to Venezuela, he said, where it was dangerous to be gay. He illegally assumed another man's identity and with it applied for a passport in order to travel to Australia for the Carlos hoax. I felt like a phony, but I had to go along with it, Alvarez said. He was charged with aggravated identity theft and making a false statement in the application and use of a passport. Alvarez/Arteaga faced a $250,000 fine, up to 10 years in prison, and deportation. He was eventually released pending trial. After numerous high-profile magicians and skeptics wrote to the judge on his behalf, including the magician Penn Jillette and the biologist Richard Dawkins, Alvarez was given a lenient sentence. In defense of Randy's participation in the deception and fraud, Alvarez said, "The reason he does what he does is to help people who are being taken advantage of. He will go to any lengths to keep somebody safe from harm, and that's what he did for me." James Randi and Jose Alvarez were married the following year. When I interviewed Randy in June 2016, he was 87 years old. In a brief moment of vulnerability, after his partner's arrest and incarceration, Randy told the Los Angeles Times that he'd felt despair. "I didn't know which way to turn. It was the hardest moment of my life. I've been dangled over Niagara Falls as part of a magic act, but nothing compares to this. Nothing," he said. When I interviewed him, I asked whether this experience had softened him in his crusade against Uri Geller. "Never," he shouted. "When I die, I want to be cremated and have my ashes blown into Uri Geller's eyes." I asked Randy what he thought of his friend Martin Gardner's conversion to religion at the end of his life. "I was surprised," he said, and quickly changed the subject back to Uri Geller. "There is no such thing as the paranormal. Uri Geller is a magician. His life is a lie." Chapter 25. The Psychic and the Astronaut. Uri Geller insists that his powers are real. So does the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. "I think he has these special powers," Netanyahu said in a television interview in 2015, and he told this story. "My wife, Sarah, and I were at a restaurant in Kesara. We were having lunch with Uri. Everyone came in and they wanted to see Uri, to have him bend their spoon. He said, 'I can't do it right now. I can't bend all these spoons.' He is very gracious, you know, but they kept asking. Finally, he said, 'Oh, all right.' So he stood at one corner of the restaurant, and he simultaneously bent the spoons of all the people who were there. The television reporter conducting the interview then asked the Prime Minister whether Geller could have performed this feat as a magic trick. "If you give me a convincing explanation how he could have worked that as a trick, I'll say, wow, he's a great magician. But he did it, and I saw it, and I've seen it time and time again. The fact that you can't explain it doesn't mean it didn't happen." The secret history of the U.S. government's investigation into extrasensory perception and psychokinesis owes much to Uri Geller. He set in motion the CIA's psychic research program. And because he captivated so many people's attention around the world, starting in the early 1970s, Geller put psychic research on the map. The first time I interviewed Geller in 2015, I traveled to his home in England. There, despite my efforts to remain a detached and objective journalist, he captivated my attention as I watched him bend spoons and appear to read my mind in a telepathy test. Before I arrived, I'd watched scores of magicians' spoon-bending videos on YouTube in order to understand how prestidigitation works, magic tricks performed by nimble fingers. My intention with Geller and with everyone else interviewed for this book was not to prove or disprove anyone or any concept, but to report objectively on the government's long-standing interest in ESP and PK phenomena. Of all the things I saw and all the people I interviewed regarding Geller, including the Nobel laureate Brian Josephson, the most telling revelation of Geller's abilities came from the legendary former curator of mammals at the Zoological Society of London, Desmond Morris. Morris wrote The Naked Ape, a zoologist's study of the human animal, which was chosen by Time magazine in 2011 as one of the best 100 nonfiction books of all time. Uri Geller came to see me in 2005 to talk about art, but when he was leaving, he asked if I would like him to bend a spoon for me, Morris recalls. I fetched a heavy teaspoon, and he rubbed it between his forefinger and thumb, and it did indeed start to bend. I watched the process very closely, but I could not see how he did this. He asked me if, as a biologist, I could explain to him how this strange ability of his could have evolved. I pointed out that iron was only discovered about 3,200 years ago, so his special ability would have been useless before that date. Morris was well aware of the controversies surrounding Geller, the legions of magicians who claimed that he used clever hand pressures to make the spoon bend, Morris said. So he asked Geller to do something unusual for him as a test. I asked him if he could do it, bend metal, using only his big toe. Morris says he fetched from his kitchen the heaviest teaspoon he could find and set it on top of his library table. Geller took off his shoe and sock and lifted his foot up, Morris recalls. He found it awkward to rub the teaspoon with his big toe, but managed to do so, and again, the spoon started bending. During this second bending, his hands were nowhere near the spoon, and he did not have enough leverage in his toes to use them to apply force to the spoon. So I was completely mystified by his ability, Morris said. I asked the zoologist what he made of this. As a scientist, I would like to make it clear that because I cannot explain how he bends the metal, this does not mean that I accept any supernatural or psychic explanation for the ability. I have studied firewalking in Fiji, and I cannot understand that ability either. If I cannot explain a phenomenon, I keep an open mind, but this does not mean that I resort to a paranormal explanation. It simply means that I have not yet found a satisfactory scientific explanation. Geller's 12,000 square foot home in Sonning on Thames is a sight to behold. Set beside the great river, it features broad lawns, several dwellings, a greenhouse, a pool house, statues by Salvador Dali, a koi pond, and a helipad. This home, which Geller shares with his wife, Hannah, is one of the many properties the Gellers own around the world. Geller says the real estate represents some of the fruits of his map-dowsing labors, by means of which he is said to have located oil and precious minerals for mining corporations. His friend and assistant of 48 years, Shippy Strang, Hannah's brother, also lives on the compound. After our interview in England, Geller agrees to let me interview him again at a later date. In 2016, I traveled to Israel to see him. He and Hannah had abruptly moved to the outskirts of Tel Aviv in the fall of 2015. I found it noteworthy that a contemporary BBC television documentary aired in the United Kingdom in 2013 and called The Secret Life of Uri Geller suggested as its central thesis that Geller worked for the present-day Mossad, the Israeli equivalent of the CIA. Mossad is responsible for covert operations, intelligence collection, and counter-terrorism, and its director reports to the Israeli Prime Minister, who in 2016 was Benjamin Netanyahu. Given Netanyahu's public statements about Geller, I found this line of inquiry worthy of investigation. Numerous U.S. government scientists interviewed for this book confirm that Geller likely worked for Mossad in the 1970s. But is Geller working for Mossad now, in the modern era? And what of his famous abilities? I went to Israel to learn more. The Geller home I visited in Israel is located in the ancient port city of Jaffa and is set high on a hill. Jaffa has had strategic military importance since prehistory, when superstition and magic influenced national security the way science and technology do now. Its harbor has been in use since the Bronze Age, circa the 2nd millennium BC, when durable weapons and proto-writing emerged. To reach Geller's place, I walk through town, past the Jaffa Clock Tower and the Al-Bar Mosque, up over Jaffa Hill and into the Old City. From there, I find my way through a labyrinth of ancient stone alleyways, through a maze of shops and homes 3 and 4 stories high, until I arrive at Geller's front door. It's spring in Jaffa, the weather is nice, and Geller likes to walk. So do Hannah and Shippy. For 3 consecutive days, we walk while I record interviews and take notes. We walk through old Jaffa, through the port, up along the coast to Tel Aviv and back. Geller is tall and thin and full of energy. He is now 70 years old. Everywhere we go, people recognize him. Back in 2007, he created and starred in a television show titled The Next Uri Geller, which aired in Israel, Germany, Sweden, Holland, Hungary, Greece, Turkey, Russia, and in the United States under the title Phenomenon. The show's talent show format presented a live audience with young mentalists and illusionists who demonstrated magic tricks, with Geller acting as the judge. The show was a hit and accounts for much of Geller's current success. As we walk around Tel Aviv, we are stopped by tourists from Germany, Ukraine, Russia, and Hungary. In the majority of encounters, Geller is asked to bend a spoon, which he does, to each stranger's delight. In the afternoon, at an outdoor ice cream shop, a young couple asks Geller to bend a spoon. At dinner, at a restaurant along the Tel Aviv seashore, our waiter asks Geller to bend a spoon. Geller goes into the back kitchen, and for an audience of roughly 20 of the staff, bends a large soup spoon and does a telepathy reading, which I videotape. When he finishes, the workers spontaneously cheer. I get energy from people, Geller says, as the four of us walk home along the beach. Late at night, we stop in a convenience store in Jaffa. Two Ethiopian Israelis recognize Geller and ask him to please bend a spoon. When no one can locate a metal spoon in the shop, one of the young men hands Uri a pair of hookah tongs, charred from handling hot coals, and asks him to bend it. Hookah tongs are made of two parallel pieces of metal, separated by roughly half an inch. Since their purpose is to handle burning coals, these tongs are generally forged to withstand high heat. Given the awkward shape, they appear difficult to bend by deception, prestidigitation, at least according to the magician's videos I watched. Standing outside under a street lamp, Geller touches the arm of the tong with his fingertip and commands, "Bend!" When the tong bends, the young men go wild with enthusiasm. The next day, I interview Geller while he exercises on a stationary bicycle in his house. "Why did you come back to Israel?" I ask. "Was it to work for Mossad?" We both know it's a rhetorical question. If he does work for them, he won't say. "Let's focus on the powers," Geller suggests. "Have you and I done a telepathy test?" Still pedaling his bike, he picks up a black ink marker and a sheet of paper. When I remind him about the telepathy test we did in England, he suggests we do another one. "Clear your mind," he says. "I'm going to place a thought in it." "I don't want to do a telepathy experiment," I tell him. "Why not?" he asks. "It's awkward. It puts me on the spot. Besides, no one wants to read about it. It's like hearing about someone else's dream secondhand," I say. Ignoring my request, Geller gives me instructions about how this telepathy test is going to work. He says he's going to write down a capital city on a piece of paper out of my view. Then he's going to hide the paper and send me the word telepathically. "The transmission will come from my mind to your mind," he says. "You're going to write down the word that you receive from me." This is the test Geller is most famous for, planting a thought in someone's mind. In declassified documents, the CIA calls this phenomenal ability of Geller's mind projection. The only person who would be able to cheat in this scenario is the receiver, me. Geller writes a word on a piece of paper, folds it in half, tells me to clear my mind. I say, "I really don't want to do this." "It's done," he says. "Tell me the city." "Paris or Scotland," I say. I know Scotland isn't a city, but that was the second thing that came to mind. Geller unfolds the paper. It reads, "Paris." Paris is generally considered one of the 10 most popular cities in the world, but still. He says, "Let's do an image now," and quickly begins drawing. He folds this paper in half and puts it out of view. "Draw," he commands. A snowman comes to mind, so I draw three different sized circles. "Stop." Geller turns over his paper. "Look," he says, "mine's a cat." He has drawn two different sized circles, one above the other with ears on top. "What's important here," he says, "is this." He takes my paper and holds it up to his. The circle in the middle of my snowman is identical in size to the center circle in his cat. "It's like a mimeograph or a Xerox copy," Geller says, measuring it to the millimeter. He is correct. "You see, there is something going on here neither of us understands," Geller says. "My brain sent the image to your brain. Modern computers can do this instantly over the internet. Geller does it with his mind, somehow engaging or entwining my mind with his. Or did he? Maybe it's common to draw a circle, one of the oldest shapes in the human psyche. Maybe it was just a lucky guess." I still want to know about the Mossad. In addition to interviewing Geller, I'm in Israel to fact-check stories from his early days in the 1970s. I interview a former officer with the Israel Defense Forces who confirms that Geller used to map douse for Moshe Dayan. I interview Amnon Rubinstein, the founding father of Israeli constitutional law and the Israeli equivalent of a long-serving U.S. congressman. Rubinstein served as Minister of Communications, Minister of Science and Technology and Space, and Minister of Energy and Infrastructure, and has been an outspoken proponent of Geller's ESP and PK abilities since 1969. I ask Rubinstein about Geller's work for Israeli intelligence. "Oh, I wouldn't know anything about that," he says politely and switches topics. One day, Uri, Hannah, Shippy, and I drive to Abu Ghosh, an Arab village located 9 miles west of Jerusalem. March 2016 is a violent time in Israel known as the Intifada of the Individuals, or the Knife Intifada, marked by lone wolf stabbing attacks by Palestinians. Since September 2015, a total of 225 casualties have been attributed to the Knife Intifada. 48 hours before I arrived, a Palestinian went on a stabbing rampage in Jaffa, wounding 10 people, including a pregnant woman, and killing an American graduate student named Taylor Force. In what seems like a cruel twist of fate, Force, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, had recently served 2 tours of duty as an army officer in Iraq and Afghanistan. The stabbing occurred 3 blocks from the hotel where I'm staying. Whenever I pass by, I regard the dark bloodstain on the sidewalk. Inside the Arab restaurant in Abu Ghosh, we appear to be the only non-Arabs, 3 Israeli Jews and an American. Lunch is served. Falafel, hummus, olives, salad, bread. We eat. In comes a man carrying a briefcase. A young blonde woman is with him. "I don't have to be psychic to tell you that man is a lawyer," says Geller. He stands. The 2 men shake hands and exchange a few words in Hebrew. The man introduces the young woman as his daughter. During lunch, we discuss anonymity. This is the only place we've been during my trip where Geller hasn't been approached by fans. It's the first time we've sat down for more than a few minutes, and no one has come up and asked him to bend a spoon. Geller says he enjoys the attention. "Maybe there's some egotism on my part," he says, "a streak of narcissism. But everyone has this. Maybe it is dormant in them." After lunch, we have coffee with cardamom and dessert. Geller disappears into the back of the restaurant, to bend spoons, I think. We regroup in the parking lot. I ask about Mossad from a different angle. If, hypothetically, the Mossad needed someone with a psychic ability, what ability would be useful to an intelligence agency? Geller tells me that he will never confirm or deny that he works for Mossad. I tell him that unless I learn otherwise, this part of the story seems more like fiction than fact, a carryover from his childhood experience with the grain trader Yoav Shakem, who challenged him to be a good soldier and someday work for the legendary Mossad. Perhaps it's egotism on his part, but this slips out. "You don't get it," he says, an edge to his voice. "The Arab restaurant, the lawyer, the daughter. I can go anywhere. No one suspects me. It's the perfect cover. I'm just the guy who bends spoons." Like Frank Sinatra, Mo Berg, Harry Houdini, or Louis DeWall, all of whom worked for intelligence services, and none of whom were suspect because each was so famous in his professional field. Maybe, I think, maybe not. And if true, What would this mean with regard to his alleged powers? Would that mean the powers are deceptive? Or would that mean he really has powers and that he uses them as a spy? It's a rabbit hole of possibilities, a puzzle that cannot easily be solved. But then something very unusual happens. We drive to Jerusalem. In the old city, we park the car and walk a little until we come up to a barricade. In Hebrew, the placard on the barricade reads, "The Office of the Head of State, the Prime Minister." Heavily armed guards wave us through. We enter the residence of Benjamin and Sarah Netanyahu, passing through intense security. My handbag goes through an X-ray machine. This is an informal meeting, not a reporting trip, I am told. We sit in the garden courtyard with Sarah Netanyahu and the family dog, a white Siberian named Kaya. The dog is old and has a terrible limp, which we discuss for a few moments. Kaya sits down at Uri's feet. Sarah works full-time as an educational psychologist for children in Jerusalem, and she has just finished a long day of work. We discuss many interesting topics, but all of them are off the record. When a bird flies into the courtyard, Kaya gets up and runs after it. "The dog is running," I say. We all watch the dog chase the bird around the garden. No limp. Sarah is equally surprised. "Uri, you healed Kaya," she says. "I'm not a healer," Geller clarifies, "but she does look better." Geller stands up and excuses himself. He will be gone for a little while and then he will be back, he says. He and Sarah disappear into the kitchen. Is this how it works? Is this the real world of espionage unfolding in front of me? Does Geller really gather information and bring it here, to the Prime Minister's house himself? Maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe Uri Geller and Benjamin Netanyahu are just old friends. The story Netanyahu told a television reporter of Geller bending spoons en masse comes to mind. Why would the Prime Minister of Israel say such a thing unless he believed it? Unless it was part of a disinformation campaign, another rabbit hole. Either could be true. Either Uri Geller works for the Mossad or he doesn't. Either he has extraordinary powers that no one in the world has been able to explain, or he's performed a singular magic act for 48 years. Perhaps the true energy source powering the phenomena is conviction. Conviction of belief. The belief that there is something more out there, that all things are connected in ways science simply cannot yet explain. Perhaps reality really is what one perceives it to be. Whether ESP and PK are fact or fancy, as Carl Jung once remarked, they just don't seem to go away. What is known for certain is that over a span of decades, hundreds of people, led by a small cast of about a dozen scientists, have worked at the request of the U.S. military and intelligence community, spending untold millions of dollars to use the human mind to do what many believe is impossible. Hannah, Shippy, and I sit in the Netanyahu garden and drink coffee. It's just the three of us enjoying an evening in Jerusalem, one of the most storied cities in the world. Or so it seems. Shippy tells me that whatever I say can be heard, whatever I do can be seen. There's a security team behind the black glass wall to my right. All kinds of people are watching and listening, he says. This is the home of the Prime Minister of Israel. We are in the Middle East, one of the most volatile and violent regions in the world. Nothing here in Jerusalem is simple, and nothing is only what it seems. Soon it is time to go. Uri Geller emerges from the back of the residence, and we are escorted through a long hallway through the security office, and then outside. Night has fallen. The heavily armed security guards continue to patrol the streets. One by one, the Prime Minister's security detail outside recognize Geller. One of them asks him to bend a spoon. The month after I returned home, an article entitled "Israelis Find New Tunnel from Gaza into Israel" appeared in the New York Times. Benjamin Netanyahu was quoted as saying that the state of Israel has achieved a global breakthrough in the ability to locate tunnels, and that the breakthrough was unique, but he could not provide any details of the technology involved. The tunnel did not have an exit at the surface, said Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, a spokesman for the Israeli military, which means that it was detected deep underground. I asked Geller whether map dowsing was involved. I can't comment, he wrote in an email. I asked Dan Williams, the Thomson Reuters senior correspondent for Israel and the Palestinian territories, what he thought. I have not heard about map dowsing being involved in Israel's tunnel detection technology, Williams said. My gut tells me it's unlikely, given the skepticism such a method would meet from Israeli planners and the big expense and human stakes of this project. From the little I've been told, the technology combines half a dozen methods, including seismic mapping and above-ground radar. In March 2015, I traveled to Florida to see Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man on the moon. His Lake Worth home is situated in a middle-class neighborhood 10 miles from the sea. I drive along a single-lane paved road through a forest of palm trees, struggling to identify which house is his. Then I spot an American flag raised high on a flagpole rippling in the morning wind. I park in the circular driveway and walk to the front door. Accompanied by his dog, Mitchell greets me at the threshold. He wears a tan shirt with a pen tucked in a buttonhole and brown slacks with suspenders. The house has a 1970s feel. The walls are adorned with Apollo 14 memorabilia and artifacts. There are many NASA photographs of the moon, Cone Crater, the Fra Mauro Highlands. In numerous images, a much younger Ed Mitchell stands smiling beside presidents and kings. In another, the Apollo 14 astronauts are greeted by U.S. Navy personnel after splashdown. In the living room, Ed Mitchell and I sit on reclining chairs. I set up my tape recorder and begin taking notes. We discuss Mitchell's background, his work, the moon, consciousness, anomalous mental phenomena, and Uri Geller. The relationship between the two men was unique. They were like two sides of the 1970s psychic research coin. In Israel, Geller told me that Ed Mitchell's support of him had a profound impact on his life, and that without him, he would not have become the person he is today. I idolized him, said Geller. He walked on the moon. That he supported me made me feel extraordinary, like I could do anything. Upon returning from the moon, Mitchell had experienced a paradigm shift. Forever after, he saw the world through a different lens. Uri Geller represented everything Ed Mitchell wanted the world to embrace, Mitchell says. They became each other's foils. Both men were lionized and criticized in equal measure. Geller for his powers, Mitchell for his belief in Geller's powers, and alleged psychic abilities like them. Uri Geller rose above the controversy. Ed Mitchell was crushed by it. I want to show you something that demonstrates what Uri Geller is capable of making happen, Mitchell tells me during our interview. I follow him through the house to a room in the back and into a walk-in closet where he kept a safe. Mitchell enters the combination and swings open the heavy door. Inside, he says, are several items that mean the world to him. The first is a set of laminated papers. I can see columns of numbers and symbols neatly written in black ink. Star, cross, wavy line, circle, and square, Mitchell says, pointing. Five of the most archetypal symbols on Earth. Symbols that have appeared on cave walls and potsherds and graves since man has been making his mark on history. These are the Zenner card logs I recorded in flight, Mitchell explains. The physical evidence of the ESP tests Mitchell conducted in secret on the way to and from the moon. They're meaningful relics, moon voyage artifacts. For all of our history, man was earthbound. Then, starting in 1969, owing to the minds and abilities of American scientists and engineers, man left Earth to make 6 trips to the surface of the moon. Mitchell hands the laminated papers to me. There is a golden seal in the upper right corner, folded across the seam. The papers look old and worn. In 2 places, there are water stains. At the bottom, a blue tape label reads, ESP note card used in flight by Edgar Mitchell on Kitty Hawk. I recognize the labeling technology, the handheld dynamo label maker from the 1970s. Next, Mitchell takes out a bent spoon, twisted at the neck. The spoon was not bent by Uri Geller. This was bent by a child after Geller appeared on a television show, Mitchell says. I'd gone on the Jack Parr television show with Uri, he explains, and Uri encouraged children at home watching to try psychokinesis for themselves, to command their spoons to bend. And all over the world, they did. A mother sent this to me. She said it had been bent by her son. The bent spoon inspires him, Mitchell tells me. Children who grow up believing they can do anything generally do great things. Children like him. He was a Depression-era kid, impoverished, he says, but people around him helped him have dreams, and despite the odds, he learned how to fly at age 13. The rest of his life story is well known. The question people should ask themselves, he says, what are we really capable of? Space travel, psychokinesis. What else can we do that we think we can't? These are the questions I've wondered all my life. Everyone has heroes. Ed Mitchell is one of mine. In researching and writing this book, Awash in Anomalous Mental Phenomena, Ed Mitchell's professional work on Apollo 14 was, for me, a beacon of ground truth. To read the 1,019-page Apollo 14 transcript, a chronicle of the 216 hours Ed Mitchell, Alan Shepard, and Stuart Roosa spent in outer space, is to read a testament of what extraordinary human functioning really is. Because of the near-catastrophic failure of the Apollo 13 mission, the Apollo 14 astronauts were under intense pressure to make the mission appear as if everything were rosy. NASA could not afford any negative publicity, the astronauts were told. The entire Apollo program was at risk of cancellation if anything went wrong on Apollo 14. When Mitchell and Shepard faced an extraordinary problem having to do with the guidance system on the spacecraft, they had to forfeit communication as they traveled around the dark side of the moon while the problem was being solved. How many people could function under pressure like that? The astronauts persevered and succeeded. That, to this reporter, is truly phenomenal. I think forever humans have asked the question, who are we? Mitchell observes. Why did we get here? What is this really all about? And all of our science, all of our religions, all of our studies have presumably been adding something to the answer to that question. And we frankly still don't understand. We still don't have the answer. We still don't know. One answer we have. He launches into a brief summary of his theory about extraterrestrial visitors to our planet when he's interrupted by a knock at the door. Believers, those sheep, would call this a deus ex machina moment. Unbelievers, goats, would say this was interesting timing. One of Mitchell's assistants presents the visitor. It's a technician from AT&T. "I'm here to fix the internet connection," the man says. Mitchell stands up, and I do too. "Yes, yes, come in." Mitchell welcomes him. The technician looks about 25 years old. He has thick red hair, a long beard, is tall and overweight. He wears an AT&T logo shirt, jean shorts, sneakers, and tall white socks. "Where's the box?" he asks. There is an awkward moment of silence. Mitchell is from my grandmother's era, a time when manners dictated that when a guest arrives, expected or not, you take a moment to make introductions so everyone present knows who everyone else is. "I'm not sure if you know who I am," Mitchell says politely. The man looks around. The moon artifacts and iconic photographs that adorn every wall don't seem to register on the technician. "If you're familiar with who I am," Mitchell restates. "Nope," the technician says, uninterested. Silence. "This is Edgar Mitchell," I say brightly, pointing. "He was the sixth man to walk on the moon." "I was an astronaut on Apollo 14, Mitchell clarifies, with the good kind of pride. The technician shrugs. "Yeah, well, I'd like to get the fuck off this planet, too," he says. "So where's the box for the internet?" And that's that. The tragedy of being an Apollo astronaut becomes real. For many, the power of the moon voyages has faded over time. Mitchell points, and the man disappears into the back part of the house. Like a gentleman, Ed Mitchell motions for me to sit back down. I reach into my bag to retrieve an item I've brought for the interview. It's a copy of the map Mitchell carried on the moon, downloaded from NASA's website. I hand it to him. We discuss the moon map. There's a NASA photograph of Mitchell holding this map on the moon, and when I saw it, it made me want to write this book, I say. All work requires effort. All goals require conviction. All conviction is entwined with doubt. Belief gets us where we are going, but what saves a man when he gets lost? This, I tell Ed Mitchell, is the question I came to ask. Mitchell reviews the map, then apologizes. "I'm not so good at map reading these days," he says. We sit quietly. In the background, in another room, the AT&T technician can be heard banging around. Mitchell sighs and says, "I'm not so good at traveling anymore. I fatigue. You, the adventurer, the great explorer, is that difficult to accept?" I ask. "Yes." "Well, no," he says. "I travel by Skype now." And then he says, "I'm in the final stages of my life. I'm content." The dog barks. It's time for me to go. 11 months later, Edgar Mitchell died. His passing coincided by a matter of hours with the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 14 moon landing, the moment Mitchell set the Antares down on the lunar surface, just 87 feet from its target. So Ed Mitchell is stardust again, as he had always been. We are all made of stardust, of elements created in explosions in the depths of space. In the most elemental way, we are all connected. deep questions go to the root of that connection. The Cold War spawned more scientific inquiry than anyone on Earth could have dreamed of at the time. Carl Jung was right. What is possible, what becomes reality, emerges from the rational assumptions of the age. As new documents become declassified and sources talk about their roles in secret ESP and PK programs, past and present, clarity will improve. With advances in new technologies, scientists will begin to see under the surface, learn to ask new questions, and move from hypothesis to general theory. There is no question that man is extraordinary, each of us a phenomenon. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Phenomena, the Secret History of the U.S. Government's Investigations into Extrasensory Perception and Psychokinesis. Written by Annie Jacobson. Read by the author. Production supervised by Tommy Herron. Produced and directed by Dennis Kao. Sound editing by Sean Bolter and Ian Lehman. Mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley. Phenomena is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2017 by Annie Jacobson. Audio production copyright 2017 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.